This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest 5-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
For many Christians, there is a sense of what we call supersessionism, meaning that the belief that when Jesus came and after he died and was resurrected and ascended, that all of the things from Judaism and from the Old Testament kind of just ceased, they just kind of wiped away. And one of those is the Sabbath, which is a bit ironic because it being, you know, one of the Ten Commandments and there from the beginning and certainly integral to you know, the Pentateuch or the first five books of the Bible. But it is one of these things, and I think probably Christians misunderstand it because in the New Testament, we so often see Jesus in these confrontations with the Pharisees, and the Pharisees are the bad guys, the legalists, and Jesus has come to give us freedom and love and free from all those rules. And so I think the Sabbath got tied up in that notion of kind of the misunderstanding that God's law was somehow bad and Jesus came to make things good. And so we as Christians don't need that law anymore. Kind of a misreading of Paul and a misreading certainly of the Old Testament. And so I think the sad thing is that I've found that most Christians that I encounter have no kind of understanding of the Sabbath, certainly of what it meant in the Old Testament and what it meant to God's people, but then also have really no understanding about what it means to in the New Testament, in this new age of the Spirit in Christ's risen age, and how we can still delight in that rest. And I think maybe more than ever in our technological age, we are certainly 100% of people who are desperately in need of that rest and finding those moments of kind of sanctifying holy time in our lives. And I think that's a sad thing. I think that's what Christians generally miss or generally misunderstand about what the Sabbath actually is.
So there are a lot of layers in what you just said. One of them would be just how important the Sabbath is in both the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, and the New Testament. When I was researching for a book on ritual, I was actually shocked to find out how often the neglect of the Sabbath or the practice of the Sabbath is mentioned by the prophets. You know, when they're excoriating Israel for their evils, you know, like they don't do the Sabbaths, right? Or the eunuch in Isaiah who will be joined to God's people, the one who keeps the Sabbath at least will be. So why do you think it is so central? We'll just start with Israel, and we'll just assume that whatever's true of Israel is in some way true of us as well. What is so important about the Sabbath for Israel, for ancient Israel?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, and I trace some of this out in the book, but I think the main thing for me, you know, and there's all sorts of debates as when what was written and who wrote it and all that kind of stuff. So we won't get into that, but the Sabbath, you know, I mean, one of the first things we see about the Sabbath is obviously it's in Genesis chapter 1. I mean, you can't get any more in your face in terms of the biblical text than opening a book and reading it in the first chapter. This is what God did. Rested on the seventh day, blessed the Sabbath day and or the seventh day, and then consecrated it or made it holy. So this is fascinating thing about holy time. But then you get into this wonderful and beautiful kind of weaving in of the Sabbath. This is what I love about the Old Testament and the biblical authors is they take these ancient historical stories, and in this case, the story of the manna in the wilderness. And so here you have Israel, you know, the Hebrew slaves have been delivered from Egypt and they're wandering out through the Sinai Peninsula. They're about to die, basically, and they complain of having no water. God provides water, and then they complain of having no food, and God provides the manna. Now, that in and of itself is, you know, I mean, that's a pretty handy miracle as far as I'm concerned, you know, that God can feed, you know, that many hundreds of thousands or however many ever came out of Egypt. But the double kind of teaching, and this is where I think the ancient writers were so clever, is that then you have this whole added layer on that story as not God just providing for his people in this wilderness wandering, but that he will consistently provide every week double the amount on the sixth day so that all of the Israelites can rest with their families and celebrate on the seventh day. And so you have in that manna story this wonderful wrapping and interweaving of themes of trust and of obedience. And at this point in the Bible and at this point in Exodus, Israel hasn't been given the law at Sinai. They haven't received the covenant law. And so we see, you know, one of the images and one of the motifs in Exodus, when when Israel comes out of Egypt, you have, you know, kind of all of these symbols of blood and water and everything kind of alluding to birth and new life. And so Israel is literally birthed out of the depths of the Reed Sea as they come up, and God uses the phrase, "Israel is my firstborn son." And so you have this wonderful, this wonderful father son or father child image in the wilderness wanderings that I think so many people lose, and sometimes Christians lose, because I think they have, you know, maybe this kind of, you know, kind of distorted perception of God as kind of the law giver, as if he's, you know, kind of just the judge sitting up in heaven, you know, waiting to kind of smack down on his people when they disobey. And but in this instance, you see, and this comes into your some of the things that you've written on ritual, but here you see that the way God teaches his people to understand who he is and who they are as his beloved children is through this ritual practice of him providing, of them trusting, and of them ceasing on the seventh day. And so you get this sense of God's, you know, God the Father kind of teaching and training, as it were, raising his son in the wilderness in this beautiful way, and teaching his son, okay, this is how you live. You know, this is the rhythm that I have set into the foundation of creation, of all creation. And now I want you as a people to follow that. Follow me into that seventh day of holy rest. And that to me is, you know, and so, I mean, that's just the, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg. But I think that to me kind of begins, you know, this long journey of how the Sabbath, and, you know, and there are also big chunks of the section. I mean, basically all the histories, you know, from Joshua to 2 Kings, you know, we almost hear nothing of the Sabbath. It's really not until Nehemiah again, who gets really, you know, gets really, really freaked out about Sabbath practice. But
walking the gates of the city on the
Sabbath. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you get these kind of Monty Python images of him throwing, like, you know, gourds and pumpkins down people's heads, you know, for disobeying the Sabbath. Right. But I think that's the, I think at its core, I mean, obviously it comes into place, you know, in the commandments. It will come into place in Sinai in the commandments. But I think this is one of the beautiful things that I kind of discovered as I was studying this about the Sabbath is that it's really not, and just as you mentioned in Isaiah, the eunuchs and kind of these foreigners joining themselves to the Lord through Sabbath obedience, it's really the Sabbath is this gift for not just for Israel, but it's actually for the whole of humanity. Because really, the way the ancient biblical authors saw it was that this was a rhythm that was a gift for Israel, but it was also a gift for all nations. You know, that this is goes back to the very beginnings of creation, you know, and that I think is to me, I mean, and there are very few things, you know, that kind of do go back to Genesis 1 in the sense of consistently coming up in the script, right, in the scriptures, you know? So I think that's one of the kind of main things in terms of, you know, for me the Sabbath is ultimately, you know, God's gift to his people in teaching them kind of the rhythm that he desires, and the rhythm that is to lead us into kind of our human flourishing, for lack of a better word. Everybody uses the word flourishing.
I know. I always refer to synonym, but it really is one of the best metaphors out there.
It really is, isn't it? I keep catching myself saying it, but I'm like, oh, but it's a good word.
I actually asked Jonathan Pennington, who's one of our fellows, because he has a book called Someone on the Mountain, Human Flourish. And I was like, are there any synonyms? He's like, no, I've looked, but I can't find them. So mail your synonyms into Center for Hebraic Thought, all of you, that you find one. I hadn't thought about until I read this book that's called Sabbath Rest, The Beauty of God's Rhythm for a Digital Age that you wrote. I had not thought of the manna episode that way. It was striking to me. And honestly, what that little insight does, it opens, it's like a key that opens several doors, is you also realize, oh yeah, God was providing, but they had to go out and work for this.
Yeah.
And they were even relieved from the provision work on that one day. And then that was going to be like working, trusting God on the seventh day when they entered the land and were actually working fields, right? Mm. Trying to get to grow. I think it's hard for us to appreciate. I've had to read quite a bit on agrarian subsistence farming in the ancient world, yep. trying to understand the Iron Age Israelites situation. But you realize the temptation really is to work 7 days a week, right? Yeah. Just to manage your crops and your flocks very carefully so you lose nothing because you don't want to starve to death.
That's, yeah.
I don't know what shocks Christians more in some ways when you talk about Sabbath, that the fact that you really, God, it seems like really God does want us to rest one day a week as part of his plan for humanity, or that he wants us to work 6 days a week.
Yeah, and that's right.
Like the French 3-day week is not the way, that it's not God's way. And maybe exactly. Even the American 5-day week is not God's way. Now I think that has to be improvised in some way.
But. I love that. I was teaching on this one time at a church, and it was the first time someone had asked that. They said, you know, it's really great that you're telling us that we should have a day of rest 1 day a week. But actually, I really need 2 days a week for my weekend. I started laughing. And he said, does that mean like I'm sinning against God? And I was like, no, it doesn't mean you're sinning. And I said, look, I said, you've got to understand. I mean, and I think this is the funny thing. I think once you start getting really deep into Sabbath and you start talking about rest, excuse me, you can forget that that actually God, you know, God still wants us to be blessed and refreshed and whole for our 6 days of work. So like I try to tell people that, like, you know, look, what I'm not kind of promoting is a, you know, go work in Manhattan, you know, blitz, you know, your, you know, work for some big hedge fund, you know, blitz your mind to its max, you know, 20 hours a day. And then, you know, if for 6 days and then, you know, and then on the seventh day, take a rest, you know, that's not it at all. I mean, I think this is one of the things that I've found so fascinating when I kind of got in, you know, maybe about kind of 5 years ago or something like that, when I really committed myself to practicing Sabbath and to keeping a Sabbath, one of the things that I found was that actually you can pretty easily sustain a 6-day working week,
right,
if you're incorporating all of these kind of all of the gifts that come with Sabbath, in the sense of, you know, you rest, you're refreshed, you know, you let your mind go from all of, you know, your things, your work, what you do in the world. And, you know, and then you come back to your work really refreshed. And so you bring that sense of rest into your work, but you realize that, you know, once you get into your work, you start to, at least for me, I really started to begin to see the unhealthy patterns that I had in my own working. So it was, you know, I needed to figure out what my boundaries were in work. And that was actually a direct result of, you know, of my learning to practice the Sabbath. And the other part of that, which I really had to learn, which was maybe one of the biggest things, when I first started this, you know, and really kind of just was convicted in my studies and wanted to begin practicing the Sabbath, you know, one of the first things, I mean, I swear to you, Drew, I mean, I haven't I haven't been a drug addict, but if I had been a heroin addict, I think giving up my phone and my screens for one 24-hour period a week was pretty much, I felt like a heroin addict coming off of drugs. I mean, I can't even tell you, like, the thing sitting next to me on the, you know, on the bedstand or on the table next to the, you know, next to the couch. I mean, it was just this constant, I had to get to a point where I would like put it in a drawer so I couldn't see my phone. And then that would kind of help me out.
Challenge with my students, where I challenge them not to look at a screen or text or anything for a week.
Oh,
you know, most of them, they have to go 24 hours, but some of them go the full week. And I have them chronicle it in a journal. And one of the shocking things to me when I first did this last year was you read their journals, or like their day-by-day journaling, and you would have sworn they were coming off drugs.
Yeah.
Like they were in the full range of emotions that peaked in like day three. Exactly. And, you know, by day seven, they calm down, they can kind of see things more clearly. But there, I mean, there were some that were like openly angry at me
for,
why did you ask me to do this? I realize everything's wrong. It's amazing what that little black square has done for it, for us, and how you talk about in the book, how it's not an accident. It's actually designed to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So many things to unpack with Sabbath. I mean, I know it's funny because so many Christians don't practice it. I think part of that too is the social structures that used to foster Sabbath keeping. And we think of Sabbath here as a Sunday ritual in America.
Mm.
But, you know, it used to be, as they say, you know, there was church on Sunday. There were no Little League game scheduled, or, you know, there was basically, the stores were closed, you know, you could only buy bread and milk and that kind of thing. Living in Jerusalem. Have you ever lived in Israel?
I haven't lived there. Been there, but haven't lived
there. You've been there on a Sabbath.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
You know, especially I lived in Jerusalem for a semester, and it was great, especially with kids, is on Shabbat.
Yeah.
You could like walk down all the streets in the middle of the streets because there are no cars.
There's no one there. I know.
Yeah. And, you know, and their stores are all closed. You know, they usually have a non-Jew working in a convenience store. So if you need something emergency, you can get it. But you feel Sabbath, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you talk to people, baby boomers especially, they remember what it feels like to kind of have this Sunday version of Sabbath. And I think now what you're asking us to do when you suggest Sabbath in the book the way you do, which I think is spot on, you're actually asking us to be freakish and weird in some way, I think. Is that right?
To be freakish and weird?
Yeah, to be the weird one. And this is what a lot of my Orthodox Jewish friends say, is they like one thing we know is we know how to be weird in a society. Like, we know that we're the oddballs. We look different. We eat different. We act different, you know. And that Christians don't really have that sensibility anymore.
Yeah, no, and I think that's exactly it. I mean, I think that's part of the, I think that's part of being, you know, being in the world, but being, you know, being a witness to the world. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, that's where Sabbath to me becomes such a, you know, such a powerful witness in terms of, you know, and not just on a, you know, by no means just on a personal level. That's the other thing about the Sabbath, is once you start digging into it and you start unpacking it and getting into those layers, you realize, especially by the time you get to the book of Leviticus, you realize that it's not just a question of my personal refreshment, but that in fact, actually it's God's prescription for, you know, rest and refreshment for the entirety of creation. You know, that you know, you can't work your animals on that day, and you can't, you know, the fields have to lie fallow for, you know, on the Sabbath year and on the Sabbath day. You know, all of these things that we do, you know, in the work of our lives, kind of keep us busy and do all these things. You know, God is just, you know, I mean, you know, literally with a megaphone saying, stop, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, there's not many biblical commands, you know, apart from like, you know, don't worship idols, you know, in Deuteronomy and things like that, or smash down all the others. You know, there aren't many, you know, kind of commands that are just so much like God has a bullhorn and is just screaming and saying, just cease, you know, yeah. do what I do. I'm God. I didn't need to stop on the seventh day. I could have kept going, but I did. Exactly. I stopped for your sake. Right. And so, you know, so it is one of these things. And like, I think when I've been so shocked about it in kind of, you know, in writing the book and then also in just chatting with people, you know, and then, I mean, even on top of that, there's the whole kind of social justice element in terms of, you know, your slaves resting, the people who work for you, all of that kind of stuff as well. But I think what I've been shocked about is sometimes the response. I mean, this has been, you know, from my students, I teach at a theological seminary in London, and even some of the responses from my students, I've had students come up to me after, you know, after lectures and say, you know, that, and these are good, you know, God-fearing Christians, I hope. And they said, you know, I really love the idea of Sabbath. I love the idea of rest. But I just can't do it. You know, my life is too crazy. Mm-hmm. I love coming back with the response of yes, because that's exactly why you need to be taking a Sabbath. And then I remember one woman saying, like, you know, well, who's going to do this? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do this? And who's going to do all these things? And I said, look, I don't have the answers to how to sort your life out. That's what I'm not here to do. I'm here to teach you theology and the Bible. And I said, look, you know, I'm just telling you what God commands you to do. Like, I'm not telling you anything else. I'm just telling you what the Bible says. You know, this is not rocket science here. This is like the Ten Commandments. You know, this is the fourth commandment. You know,
I'm laughing because I've had this conversation so many times.
We're in top five territory here in terms of the Ten Commandments. You know, and that just blows my mind that people have like the nerve to say, well, it's great that God says love your neighbor, but you know what? I'm just too busy. I can't do that. You know, and you just think, wow, we've got to talk about what it means to follow Jesus. But it's, so it is one of those things that I think to me, Drew, and I think you probably agree, that is just so symptomatic of our society and just where we've come to in terms of, and I think part of that, and talk about this in the book a little bit, but part of that is kind of the digital revolution that we've, you know, experienced over the last, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. 20, 30 years or something like that. But really, I mean, really probably since the advent of the smartphone. And, you know, and I think, you know, if nothing else, I mean, what I try to talk to people about is just, you know, and I, believe me, I've been like battling with clergy who tell me that like, they're never mm-hmm. supposed to take a Sabbath.
I'm like,
no wonder you're burning out. But anyway, but I just say to people, look, you know, you might not believe me, like, that's fine. You know, we can argue the biblical text and we can argue about how Jesus teaches the Sabbath. You know, all I'm telling you is that it seems pretty plain to me in scripture that this is what God has commanded us from the beginning of creation, and that it's been integral to his people's life. And I don't think that stops with Jesus. I think it's something that continues today, because I think the Sabbath is a gift. And then usually I end by saying, you know, just do me, you know, just humor me and go and for a month, take 4 weeks, and take a Sabbath each week and literally do no work on that day, and, you know, worship God, do whatever you can, and tell me if it was a good thing or a bad thing. Mm. You know, and I don't know anybody who's ever come back to me after actually doing that and saying, yeah, you know what, that was just a waste of time.
You know, we can blame the phone, but I think we also have to blame, you know, the church's insistence, you know, in the West, that basically the soul is the site of all God's operations.
Mm, yes.
And that, you know, there's no way to do Sabbath just in your soul, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Can I just like take 20 minutes and in my mind personally expand that out to
personal
24
retreat.
Hours? Yeah. And yeah, so it was like I was Sabbathing for 20. It's like, no, you actually have to put your body into the practice for 24 hours or how, you know, the full day.
Yeah.
And there's no way around it. Like, and of course, so much of discipleship and life together is exactly that. And so Sabbath is an easy way to kind of chip away at that soul-centeredness of some versions of Christianity.
Yeah. And that, let me just one last point on that, because I think that's so important. And that was the other thing that that the other kind of pushback I would get on the Sabbath when teaching on this was that the other side, and this is such a kind of common kind of Christian tact in terms of biblical exegesis understanding is to spiritualize something by the time you get right. into the New Testament. And a person came up to me and said, you know, I experience Sabbath rest all the time, you know, like, because, you know, Jesus has poured out his spirit and, you know, we now live in his rest. And he says, mm-hmm. come to me all who, you know, labor. And I said, yes, I said, you are exactly right. I was like, your spirit, your soul is communing with Christ. And if you are in that communion, like St. Teresa of Avila, and you've gone into, you know, into the innermost part of the castle, yeah. you are experiencing that rest. But you also have a physical body, and your body cannot sustain not resting. And, yeah. and this is the thing, I think, to me, and this is partially because I'm doing some studies in Leviticus right now, but just, and this kind of ties into your, some of the work that you've done on ritual, but part of it is just the, you know, kind of the light bulb moment of realizing that embodied ritual, that we are physical human beings. And I think, you know, I mean, all the interesting stuff, like all the fascinating stuff that's coming out in neuroscience, that coming out about studies about how we eat, our microbiome, you know, how our gut oh, yeah. affects our minds and our emotions and all of these things, how they're so kind of, you know, amazingly tied together. You know, we just tend to, I mean, I think there is this thing in Christianity today that is just spiritualize everything. I heard a great term. I can't remember who told this to me. He said, you know, what we have in Christianity today is this kind of neo-Gnostic angelism.
Yeah,
and I loved it.
Exactly, you know, functional Marcionism with neo-Gnosticism.
Yeah, it's exactly it. And it's this idea that, well, like, our bodies are just going to die and we're going to become angels. And I'm like, no, you're right. not going to become an angel. You're going to have a resurrected body, like a physical right. resurrected body. So yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that the physical side of it and the physical side of ritual is so critical to just who we are as human beings. And I think oftentimes that's maybe another one of the reasons why Sabbath kind of falls out of the Christian radar, is because yeah. people can just spiritualize it and say, well, you know what, I have Sabbath all the time. I don't need to take a day of rest. I'm fine.
One of my favorite lines from the Gospel of Luke is, you know, and they thought he was a ghost, and he said, give me some of that broiled fish. Yeah. And he ate it.
yeah.
Resurrection is real, folks.
Exactly. You can eat. I know.
So I have a couple questions. Actually, I have a thousand questions. I'll pare them down to two issues before we run out of time here. One is, one of our other fellows for the Center for Hebraic Thought, Joshua Berman, he loves to point out that the 7-day week is the only artifice in the calendar. So if you look in the ancient world and modern as well, like, the year is tied to our revolution around the sun, the month is tied to the moons, but there is no like 7-day period anywhere in nature. So it's a completely artificial construct by God for us. So I do wonder, and this is a question that comes up, especially if you know any Messianic Jews or if you have any Jewish friends, do you have any thoughts on the idea of the eternal Sabbath? Meaning, do you know this concept?
I don't know in Judaism, but keep going.
So that the idea that there really is like the Sabbath that happened in creation sets the date, and that there's an actual like, there's a metaphysical connection to every single Sabbath with creation. And so that's what makes each Sabbath so important.
Yeah.
And which also means you can't, like, Sunday can't be your Sabbath and Tuesday can't be your Sabbath.
I see. Yeah.
But it's actually Shabbat is Shabbat is Shabbat, and that's it.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard this idea?
No. Well, I've heard of it in Seventh-day Adventism. I didn't hear of it. I haven't heard of it as called the eternal Sabbath, but I think, I mean, I think that's a fascinating thing. You know, to me, it is a tough one. To me,
it gets at the practice of, you know, the actual nuts and bolts. How do you practice Sabbath?
Right? Yeah, exactly. And I think to me, you know, I think for the Christian, the most natural day to have a Sabbath is Sunday, because, you know, if you think about the practice of Sabbath in Judaism, you know, it was going to, well, at least for the males, and it was going to the synagogue, you know, on Saturday morning, you know, having dinner together with family or friends on a Friday evening. So to me, it makes sense in the Christian, and there's all sorts of history behind the history of the church and how Sabbath became Sabbath in the Christian church, or the Lord's Day, Sunday was called, and things of that nature. The person who really got me first kind of fascinated by the whole subject was when I picked up, and it was a long time ago, when I picked up Abraham Heschel's his Sabbath book, I just remember not being able to put that book down, and I remember thinking to myself, if this guy just threw in the word Jesus a few times, I would have thought he was an evangelical Christian. But it was just such a profound book, and so I don't think, I mean, this is just, I might be totally wrong, but this is my opinion. I don't think that the Sabbath has to be. I think it's better if it is celebrated together, because there's part of the book that I really want to press the idea of the communal nature of Sabbath, that Sabbath isn't just about in our narcissistic individual world. It's not just about my personal rest. It's actually about resting within family, within the community. And then also as Jesus shows, it's resting that can also bring, wholeness and healing to people. Whether it's the healing of diseases or whatever it is, I think this is what Jesus' witness to the Pharisees is about the Sabbath, that it's not merely, I guess, following the kind of litigious nature of what you can and cannot do or what constitutes work, as much as it is the kind of positive side of it, of this movement towards wholeness, this movement towards, God's rest, his shalom, his peace in the universe, of bringing all these things together. And so I don't hold to kind of the eternal Sabbath. I mean, there is a fascinating kind of theological idea of, God, and I think Heschel brings this up in his book, about God consecrating this day in eternity, in eternal time. And so the Sabbath in some ways is always consecrated. And then we reconsecrate it every time we, because God commands us then to command, to keep the Sabbath or obey it.
Like in a Eucharist.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, I think what's more important, because the fascinating thing in this whole journey have been talking to people about Sabbath is talking to shift workers, people who are police, doctors, nurses, when do they take Sabbath? Are they not allowed to take Sabbath because they have to work on these shift rotas? And so it got me thinking about that. And I thought, if the Sabbath is a gift, then surely the Lord's got to allow for some flexibility. So I suppose my answer would be that the best day to celebrate Sabbath is when we celebrate it together. And, so for Christians, on a Sunday, Saturday night and Sunday, for the Jew on a Friday and a Saturday. And that is kind of the optimal Sabbath celebration, as it were. But for many people, they don't have that flexibility, and they don't have that ability to, to dictate their schedule in that way. Now, some people maybe can, and maybe it's part of changing their lifestyle or their life or whatever it is. But like for me, for example, so I'm also a vicar or a priest at a local Anglican church here in Cambridge, and I celebrate on a Sunday, but having to prepare a sermon, it's still a lot of work. It doesn't feel like a day of rest. And so, so what I've basically incorporated into my life and our kind of family rhythm is that we kind of follow the traditional Jewish timing of the Sabbath, from Friday evening to Saturday evening. Cause other than my working at the college for Monday to Friday, that's kind of the one day I can really rest. So I think I'm not so bothered about, I think it's best if we can celebrate it together. Also because of the witness of what that, kind of testifies to, kind of a communal witness, together, and the witness of the church, on a Sunday. One of the great things, the great traditions in this country is the ringing of the church bells on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And there is something that
especially in Cambridge.
Exactly. Going on there, yeah. And so, kind of riding my bike down to church in Cambridge in the morning, and there's invariably like all these bells going off everywhere. it does remind you that there is, you know, kind of a proclamation that this is the Lord's Day. This is the day of rest. This is the day of celebration, day of resurrection. So I don't think I'm not overly bothered by people, you know, because I realize we do live in a strange world. We're not ancient Israelites. We're not an agrarian people. You know, we don't have necessarily the same flexibility or the same kind of rhythm of life. So I think what's more critical to me is that people, you know, find that 24-hour period in their weeks and as much as possible try to create a weekly rhythm if they can.
And I was just listening to an interview with neurologist who was talking about sleep, the importance of sleep, and one of the things that sleep does for memory. And I've been reading on memory theory lately because this is really big in biblical studies now.
Yeah.
And that sleep, you know, one of the things sleep does is it makes us forget things, the things that we don't need to hang on to, right? Yeah. And it actually collates our memories and basically does a big flush. If good sleep does, it flushes out all the stuff that we don't need and then kind of doubles down on the stuff that we do need to remember for the day and for the next day. And in that way, sleep actually is constructing our memory in some ways. And I wonder if maybe the pendulum swing here needs to be for people in the West who really aren't, most of us are not working slave away jobs, right?
Yeah.
That the pendulum swing needs to be for us thinking more of that this is actually God trying to construct us into a certain type of people. Mm. And I wonder if there's, you know, because with all rituals in the Bible, people want to ask the question, well, what's the point? I guess if you were to like thumbnail or, you know, just shoot from the hip here, to use a gun analogy, because we're Americans, what do you think it's constructing? Like, how is it constructing our view of ourselves, our understanding of ourselves, like, and specifically, like, what, you know, in other words, what do I learn from Sabbath? Even if you want to say, you know, it's something that happens over time. One of my favorite quotes, it was a tweet from Wesley Hill, who said, you know, in a period of deep depression, going to church on any given Sunday didn't help, but going to church every Sunday did.
Yeah.
And so I wonder what you see as things that we learn from Sabbath specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I can more probably give you just personal testimony in terms of what I've learned. I mean, I think one of the things, and believe me, by no means am I a Sabbath expert. I still fail miserably on trying to keep my holy day holy and to be obedient to the Lord's command. But I think a couple of things, you just mentioned about memories, and likewise, I had listened to a podcast or something about neuroscientists, and one of the analogies he used about sleep was that it's like cleaning the desktop of our brains. I thought that was such a great analogy. It's like when you clean, you clean up your desktop at the end of the day, and he's like, that's basically what sleep is, helping us organize our thoughts. And in some ways, I think the Sabbath is a similar kind of idea and a similar kind of rest, because what I've found is that when I unplug myself from the world of my working day and my working week, it gives me the space. And also a big part of my Sabbath is just getting outside, getting in creation. Mm-hmm. You know, we sit in front of computers all the time. I mean, at least in our jobs. And so just getting out, for me, it's on my bicycle. I just go out and I cycle out in the countryside and just breathe and just get refreshed. And I think that is what I've found over the years, is that day of not the lack of concern for work and the stress of work bearing kind of down on my shoulders is the moment that it's almost like the veil comes off and I can all of a sudden see things a bit more clearly. I can process things with a bit more clarity. So what's gone on in the week? Sometimes, you know, my bike rides are just thinking about things, maybe things that bothered me or things that upset me or things that were good or whatever it might be. But I think that deliberate and intentional, we'll call it a consecration of time, of making time holy, allows us to see things in a different kind of, in a different light. And so like your analogy of sleep, I think the Sabbath also kind of restructures or helps restructure our memory as we process kind of things that have gone on. And I think that's a wonderful thing about the Sabbath. The other thing, you know, and I've kind of gone through all sorts of varieties of experiments and when I've ruined Sabbaths and really kind of not had a good holy day, when I've had good days. And one of the things I learned early on, because I thought, oh, this will be such a great day. I mean, you probably know this sentiment because you and I are in the same trade, as it were, but it's, I thought, oh, this is going to be so great. I've got a day of rest. I can catch up on all the reading that I haven't done this week. And so, you know, of course,
I have committed this fallacy.
I picked up the latest, you know, and then it's so funny because I think after a couple of weeks, I tried this and I realized, I was like, oh no, you know, this is work for me. I mean, this is, you know, it seems strange, but reading books for us is part of our work actually. Right. And so all of my Sabbaths now, I never pick up a theological book, won't touch anything. You know, I'll read other books, but I will not kind of read a theology book because it just draws me back to work. And the last thing, let me just share the last thing. I think this is the component of Sabbath that I think I wasn't expecting. And what it is, you know, we kind of have almost always, certainly in lockdown, it's been great. We've been eating as a family together all the time, right. But certainly almost always we're together on a Friday evening. And I usually I'll light a candle and say a prayer and kind of welcome in this time of Sabbath. But when we sit down, what I notice about that Sabbath meal, if I know in my mind that the next day I have nothing to do, like no agenda, no work, no emails to answer, you know, no articles to read or write or whatever it is, I am present, kind of physically and emotionally present in that moment in a way that even if we eat dinner together 5 days a week, there's something different. There's just something kind of. Qualitatively different about my presence with, you know, my family, my children, or if I meet up with some friends or a friend or whatever. Not that that's happening much these days with lockdown, but you know, if it's on a Saturday and I meet up with a friend or do whatever, there is something I notice it, and what that does to me is that I think what it's taught me over the years is that is one how kind of how flighty or how out of touch sometimes I am with those around me during my regular work week because I just get too consumed by work. Like I'm just not aware of the people around me. And so that's where I think, you know, the practice of Sabbath, you know, and again, you know, continued to stumble and fall every time I, you know, I don't often have a really perfect Sabbath. There's always something I do to mess it up. But I think that practice in going through those, you know, kind of failures, what does consecrated time mean? What does it mean to have a day of holy rest? So this is not just, and this is the other thing I try to explain to people. I'm like, I'm not just talking about a day off because anybody can take a day off. What God commands is that we consecrate a seventh day as holy, you know, and so what does that mean when we kind of get into this idea of, okay, what is holy time? And what does that look like in my life? And I think that's something that, you know, just, you know, kind of even till today and year after year, I continue to wrestle with, you know, what is a consecrated day really look like?
Well, Dr. Mark Scarlatta, thank you very much for your wisdom and your guidance on this.
It's been great to be with you, Jerry.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.